Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two.
Gilmore on a big step. Oh, brother. Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me, as always, is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you, although it's for a sad reason.
Yeah, unfortunately. We get these, and we were kind of wrestling with this idea, and we've done it from time to time, you know, since we've been doing this podcast now for a little over a year, of, you know, when these sort of things happen, when, you know, an NBA legend passes away, who is worthy of, you know, us dropping everything and doing a podcast? And it's not that not all of them are, because we've done a few where we've, you know, kind of unfortunately combined, you know, guys that have recently passed away or whatever. But this one was kind of a no-brainer. The second it happened, I think you messaged me, I messaged you, and we were just like, yeah, we have to do this. Because maybe not, you know, an all-time great legendary player, but an all-time great legendary character in NBA history and basketball history, really. So yeah, it was a no-brainer that this guy deserved a special podcast for him, you know.
Absolutely. Daryl Dawkins died at age 58 this week, and was just a, you know, influential character in terms of very colorful, helped I think lead to sort of a rise of a in the NBA of the dunk as sort of a marketing tool that kind of brought young people. And I definitely know that for me, when I was a kid in growing up in the mid to late 80s, like even though he was basically done with his career by then, you know, the rim shattering, glass shattering slam dunk was definitely something that like I knew about and that I knew
done
it, you know, and that was just like that was part of like this, you know, lore of basketball, was seeing all these guys and have these great dunks, his teammate Dr. J and that sort of thing. So, you know, you just, yeah, an incredible character, a really interesting guy. He was a guy who, you know, when we first started talking about doing the pod, you know, the Over and Back podcast, he was a guy that was, you know, on the short list for guys that we, you know, wanted to do a show on. Never got the chance until now, but, and we, you know, we'll kind of get through some of the particulars of his career, later on the show, but we wanted to start off. We have a very special guest, Iago Colas, who writes for at iagocolas.com. He writes about the culture of basketball. He also has an upcoming book on that subject called Ball Don't Lie, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But Iago, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
And so, you know, Dawkins, you know, the first thing that stands out to me is that is just, you know, the incredible you know, gamesmanship, the and the just the great dunks that I do think, like during that time period in the late 70s and early 80s, there was, I think, more of an openness for the NBA to kind of embrace the dunk, like as an organization. I mean, players would certainly do it from time to time. Early on in the NBA's history, the dunk was viewed as, you know, something you didn't do was showing you up. If you did it, you'd get knocked down. Later in the 60s and 70s, it became more, you know, it accepted, at least in the program and in the college game. It was banned for a while. But I think, you know, by the late 70s, early 80s, it was something that like the NBA was opening up as, you know, to be a real major part of how it marketed the game. And that was, you know, during a time for that and for other reasons that the NBA grew in great popularity. Do you think of him as a big contributor to dunk culture? Do you kind of agree that, you know, what are kind of some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great topic. I think you've got the chronology pretty much right in the sense that it was definitely over the period of time between the late 70s and through the early mid 80s that something you could call dunk culture kind of began to appear in the NBA and among NBA fans, and then to kind of really grow. I think that it's kind of interesting when you break it down a little bit and you think about Dawkins' dunks, and you probably know that when he broke the backboard and then broke it again 3 weeks later, the NBA kind of panicked and began to levy fines for this. So I would say that I think about dunk culture in the NBA, and in general, I think about culture of basketball in relation to the NBA in terms of the sort of institutional culture that the NBA fosters, and then a more kind of subterranean, maybe even insurrectionary culture that fans of the league may tap into, that the NBA both tries to capitalize on and keep under wraps. And I think that Daryl Dawkins, as far as dunk culture goes, is definitely part of that subterranean kind of tendency or force that operates in the league. His teammate, as who you mentioned, Julius Erving, of course, kind of pioneered the halftime dunk contest at the All-Star game with his 76 free throw line dunk in the ABA. And I think that, you know, he probably had more to do with dunking in a way that the NBA began to feel might lend excitement to the game. Dawkins probably in a way that the NBA felt was a bit alarming. You know, his dunks, I think, express the kinds of things that dunks can express: strength, force, rage, destruction. And that the NBA is not all that comfortable with as values that they want to promote, and especially as values that they would like, that is to say, they wouldn't like to see those values embodied by a large black man. So I think there's a way in which for the NBA, Erving was probably more of a gateway for the dunking of, say, Jordan, which, of course, the NBA loved. And marketed all over the world, than Dawkins, who I think was a little bit too much on the edge of what the NBA was scared of. Don't forget that he was doing this, you know, breaking backboards around the time that Kermit Washington was breaking Rudy Tomjanovich's face with his punch. And so there's an association of dunking with violence, with blackness, all those kinds of things that the NBA gets real nervous about.
Mm-hmm. You know, in another way, he was kind of a threat to the kind of the way things were at the time, was that he was the first NBA player and only the second, you know, in either league to be drafted straight out of high school. And,
exactly.
You know, it's interesting. I think how that sort of filters into how he is perceived. He was always sort of perceived as someone who had raw talent, but didn't necessarily make the most of that talent, which I think is, I mean, you know, there is some, I think, validity to that. At least it seemed like he could have done more. And his teammates talk about that, you know, maybe his practice habits weren't the best or whatever. But I do feel like that's also a convenient way for fans to look, to sort of thumb their nose down at a player.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly I think there's a lot of racially based, you know, views, you know, regarding that, a fan might see someone who just looks like they should be able to dominate and doesn't quite understand why. And that, you know, and that kind of, obviously there's, that reflects upon other things in society for people who, you know, who have benefits and people who don't.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, when I encounter that sort of attitude, judgmental attitude about players who appear not to be achieving their potential or what have you, I always just kind of wonder, and if I'm working with students, ask them, what's your stake in this exactly? That is to say, why are you invested in this player becoming a certain kind of player or making sort of achieving certain things as a player? And I wonder, too, about the single-mindedness of fans who measure the value of players in relatively narrow ways. I mean, of course, everything in sports culture leads us to be looking for players to be productive statistically and their contributions to team wins and so forth. But, you know, sports is also entertainment, and a lot of us are into it for that reason as well. And, you know, it may be that Dawkins is a good reminder of the value that personality and character can add to the game. And I don't mean the kind of sort of 19th century character that means you just, you know, keep your nose to the grindstone and practice and all that, but character that reminds us that it's a game and that it's for fun. And he's enjoying himself and hopefully, you know, helping other people to enjoy themselves. And I feel a little bad for fans that can't appreciate that, or for whom worries about lost potential get in the way of just appreciating that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's something we've sort of talked about a lot on this podcast, and it's something that's actually doing this podcast has helped me a lot, because, you know, and not that I was always, you know, on board with a lot of the, you know, the hyper competitive guy. I mean, there's a lot of guys that are renowned NBA players. You know, you guys like a Kobe, you guys like a, you know, I grew up in Chicago, Michael Jordan, yes, or whatever, where, you know, when I was growing up, it was like, yeah, titles, championships, wins, woo, and all that sort of stuff. And more as I've matured, I've gotten less, you know, I'm becoming less fans of those guys and more fans of guys like Daryl Dawkins, who, yeah, you know what, you know, I didn't maybe win as much as I wanted to, and I didn't do all that sort of stuff, but that, not that they're like, there's something to be said for the guys that are, you know, not visceral, like I have to win, I have to create narratives in my head to try to take you down and, you know, destroy you and destroy, you know, your family. And that, you know, there's guys that, NBA guys, where that's just, that's it. And there's fans that respond to that. They think that every single NBA player needs to have this just untenable killer instinct, yeah, that to win or whatever. And I've gotten older. I've been like, you know what, there are guys like that. I mean, I don't think it's an effort thing. And that's always what I've sort of grown up and sort of realized, is that, you know, maybe a Daryl Dawkins, I don't think he didn't quote reach his potential or whatever based off of effort. I think he was just a guy who, you know, had a certain set of skills. And he even talks about it as well, that he came into the league and everybody said, hey, you're, you know, tall and good, you're Wilt Chamberlain. And he was like, no. I came into the league as a high schooler. I am in no way refined and no way ready to do this.
Exactly.
And he never really quite got it. And that's not a bad thing. It's just a guy that seems, even at the time, to be aware of his limitations or whatever. But you get a little, and then you realize a guy who sort of understands what he is then. And you kind of get that throughout his career, is that, you know, once he's just started letting the game kind of come to him and enjoy the game and entertain himself and entertain the fans. And you know, it's not like he didn't contribute to his team's winning. I mean, he was still a very good player. Yeah. He just wasn't the quote, oh my God, you're, you know, 6'11", 250, and you're a strong black man. You can dominate. And it's like, well, you know, maybe I can't. Like,
yeah,
I don't have the skills to do it. Like, and I never thought it was effort for him. And going back and looking at all the stuff that he did and just reading about his career and all that sort of stuff, you get an appreciation for a guy who just went out there and was himself. And I think there was a quote in one of the stories that I read that was great. I think it was the one that Dave Wohl wrote, and we'll talk about it here in a little bit, his former coach in Sports Illustrated. And he said, one of the quotes was, Daryl Dawkins said, I wouldn't change a damn thing. I always liked being Daryl Dawkins. Right. And that's perfect. Like, I read that quote and I said, yeah. And that's a guy who, after his career, was able to sort of reconcile the fact that he was, you know, somewhat out of the game, but was able to give the game to other people. He enjoyed the game so much when it was over, whereas some guys get so burnt out because every day is, you know, life or death for them, where he's a guy who doesn't mind going and coaching, you know, 10-year-old girls. When, you know, sure, if you read his Twitter account, you see pictures of him just hanging out at like rec centers or whatever and like teaching people the game. Like, he never seemed disenchanted or, you know, disenfranchised with the game, because I think he never made it anything less than something he enjoyed. And I respect that. That's a guy, now that I've gotten a little bit older and doing this podcast and other stuff, I enjoyed those sort of guys that can just enjoy what they're doing and enjoy the game and enjoy themselves and be happy with what they are and what they've accomplished. And Daryl Dawkins absolutely strikes me as one of those guys that did not care kind of how his career went. I think he was very happy with what he did and what he accomplished.
I think there's,
and yeah, he should be.
Two really important points I want to stress in what you said. I think, first of all, just that you kind of rescued the fact that it's not like he sucked.
No, God.
You know, and it's important, as we kind of talk about how fans sometimes may judge him that way, to kind of emphasize that that's actually just a misperception that people may have, and they may exaggerate his weaknesses as a result of that. But I think the other point that's especially important, and I think has a lot to do with why people sometimes do make these kinds of judgments, and that is, you know, your characterization, and by all accounts, seemed that way to me too, that he's somebody who's comfortable in his own skin, happy being himself. And I think that there's a lot of fans that aren't. And they look to NBA players who appear that way, especially those who, you know, who for whatever reason the fan imagines could be doing more, could be working harder. And I think there's a lot of projection on the part of fans of their own failures and their own disappointments and their own bitterness. And they kind of project those onto NBA players. And I think we see that Daryl Dawkins is not unique in this respect. But somebody who appears carefree rubs some people the wrong way who aren't carefree.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's better for the world to have people who are more about fun than necessarily just being single-minded about their jobs. I mean, I think you can respect, like, someone, you know, who's just a complete professional and has the awesome work ethic like Tim Duncan without feeling like denigrating Daryl Dawkins just because he didn't quite have that, even though, you know, he had a 12-plus year career as a player, contributed to winning teams, and certainly, you know, worked hard by, you know, any standard you know, that you can basically think of. Any NBA player, you know, of any length of a career is going to have to work very hard.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, I think there's one, the other thing that's a little bit part of that is maybe, I think we get some this sometimes, not just in sports, but just kind of in culture. Like, people who feel like that somebody's level of fame is bigger than their talent.
Yes.
And I think that really is, there's kind of an ugliness to that as well, or you know, are bigger than their, you know, than their production as a player in this case, you know, that I think, like, if somebody, usually a lot of the times it comes through the dunk contest, like somebody will win the dunk contest and suddenly there's heaps of expectations on them, even though they're great at dunking and they're not great at other aspects of the game. But I feel like there's definitely a backlash often when that, you know, goes poorly.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think something that, you know, contemporary fans may forget, I think I'm a bit older than you guys, just from when you mentioned that you were growing up. So I was born in the mid 60s, but you know, a high school player today coming out has resource training, conditioning, nutrition, just knowledge of the game that, for a contemporary generation of fans who are used to 18-year-olds who are, obviously they're not coming straight out of high school, but, you know, after a year of college or a year abroad, and they have benefited from a kind of mentorship, training, knowledge about fitness and conditioning and nutrition that was not available to players coming out of high school in the 1970s. So there's also kind of two different standards at work, two different contexts that I think people may not be taking into account, depending on, you know, what generation they are, when they think about Dawkins and what he could have done. I mean, I think he probably did exactly what he could have done. And it was remarkable on a lot of fronts. As you said, you know, an excellent individual player, contributor to some excellent teams, and a terrific entertainer, and culturally a really important figure in the history of the league.
Yeah. Do you have any specific memories that stand out to you for Dawkins?
Oh, well, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, those Sixers teams of the late 70s leading up to the ones that won in 83 that he was no longer a member of, they were my best friend's favorite team. And I was actually born in Portland, Oregon. So at that time, I'm somewhat embarrassed to say I was a partisan of the Trailblazers. So, of course, in 1977, you know, they faced off in the finals. And my friend and I played those games in our driveway. And I was 12, he was 13 or 14. And I was always a little bit jealous because he was the Sixers. And it looked like so much more fun to be the Sixers, including Dawkins, than to be the Blazers.
Yeah, you had to share the ball, and you couldn't
I had to
dunk,
share the ball, you know, and I'm shooting jump shots. You know, it's not
no fun.
Really fun. So yeah, he, you know, I came around. At that time, I was still struggling with, you know, who I might be and what basketball meant to me, and it still means a lot of different things to me. But that's an early memory that he's a part of there being parts of the game that were fascinating to me, but that I didn't quite have access to yet.
So Iago, you have a book coming up about the culture of basketball called Ball Don't Lie. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about it?
Right. So Ball Don't Lie is the name of the book. It will be coming out in early 2016, being published by Temple University Press. And its subtitle is Myth, Genealogies, and Invention in the Cultures of Basketball. And I mention that because each chapter addresses a myth, a genealogy, and what I call an invention for nine different moments in the history of the game, beginning with the invention of the game by Naismith in 1891 and ending in the last chapter with LeBron's decision to leave Cleveland and go to Miami in July of 2010. And basically what I try and do for each of the moments, each of those moments and all the ones in between that span from the foundation of the league to the Russell Chamberlain rivalry to the Knicks to Iverson and Jordan is try to look at particular stories that get circulated time and again among fans that crystallize around these figures and that are oftentimes not true or if not entirely false, not the whole truth. And I try to figure out why they do so much work for us. Why do we get so invested in them? Why do they stick and persist, even as historians and others begin to show us that the facts are a little more complicated? So I kind of look at that, and then I also try to offer a context in which we can see those myths differently with a critical eye, complicate their story a little bit, and in the end, in each invention, so there's an invention for each of these figures, I try to tell a different story about those figures, one that I think is more interesting, entertaining, fun, speaking of Daryl Dawkins and fun, but also I think one that I would say politically is more, let's say, amenable to me, in that I think what I have found in my research is that the myths that have really stuck in basketball history tend to be very conservative, if not at times authoritarian, and at times serving racist agendas, not to say that anybody in particular who is purveying those myths is racist, but simply in an institutional level that they tend to support kind of racist operations of NBA and basketball culture. So I'm interested in kind of breaking those myths up a little bit and trying to tell a different story that focuses more on the players and their creativity and their excellence and their autonomy, the ways in which they cannot be controlled or corralled, even if they may at times be exploited. And I think, you know, in a certain sense, I think I probably mentioned Dawkins in the book. There's no special discussion of him. But, you know, he could have an honorary chapter if I were writing it today, because I think he's a great sort of embodiment of the values that I'm trying to advance through this book of players getting free despite the cultural and institutional constraints that are frequently placed upon them.
All right. Well, that sounds really fascinating. I'm excited to check it out when it comes out. And
we'll definitely be doing a podcast about that.
Yeah,
I feel that happening.
I'll be happy to do that.
that would be great.
That is going to happen.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. And Rich and I are going to take a little break, and then we'll be back to break down some of the highlights of Daryl Dawkins' career in just a moment.
Terrific. Thanks, guys.
All right, and we are back talking more about Daryl Dawkins, Chocolate Thunder, as he was better known.
Great, what an all-time great nickname!
Yeah,
I tried to tell my fiance Michelle, who I was talking about tonight. I said Chocolate Thunder. She goes, "That's not his real nickname." I was like, "No, it is. I promise." Yeah. Like, it's an all-time great. Like,
different world back then. You know, I didn't realize, and you know, I didn't realize that apparently Stevie Wonder named him Chocolate Thunder.
Yeah, that I had no idea until today. Was the first time I realized it. That's impressive. That when you get a nickname from Stevie Wonder,
yeah,
like you've arrived. Like there's nowhere to. I mean, that's the man right there.
Yeah, and I like that. I like Dawkins' quote. Like, a guy who never saw me gave me the name Chocolate Thunder. So. although I think
debatably so. I don't know. Did you see those videos on the internet? Maybe he's not.
He's part of that. Yeah, I think Dawkins was even in that club of the Stevie Wonder truthers, the people who think he's actually not blind. Like I actually read something about it, and I was almost like, huh, that's kind of funny. Like, but anyway, this is not the Stevie Wonder Blind podcast.
What are we talking about?
Dawkins was named by Saturday Night Live as the man of the millennium in 1999.
I don't know about that. I'm going to have to take a little liberty with that.
Who contributed
the whole millennium?
Who contributed more to the millennium than Daryl Dawkins?
The whole millennium.
Yeah. I mean, he's top 10 at least.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll listen to top 10. Who's the other nine right now on the spot?
Jordan. Okay. Hitler.
I mean,
it's bad, but you know, he was important.
It's a millennium. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Julius Caesar, is he in there?
No, I believe that's the wrong millennium.
I mean, it's millennium, so yeah, got a lot.
That would be, yeah, that'd be the other one. I don't know.
It's
you
a
got
weird
me. Guy. Yeah, we'll have to table that
next podcast
discussion.
Yeah,
but... yeah. So he was a rookie in 1976. So he was drafted fifth in the 75 draft. He was the second player to come out straight from high school, and was the basically two players did. Moses Malone was the first to do it in 74, and then 75 Dawkins did it, and also Bill Willoughby, who was basically like a journeyman who lasted like 8 years or so, didn't do all that much, and they were the last two before Kevin Garnett did. So, but I mean imagine coming straight from high school in the culture of the NBA in 1976. I mean, that would be pretty difficult to do, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Like Iago said, you know, in our earlier discussion with him, is like, we kind of take it for granted now because, you know, your standard high schooler in 2015, you know, they've been, you know, playing AU basketball since they were 10. They've had access to pretty much any game that they want at their fingertips as long as they want. They've had, you know, trainers and coaches, nutrition and weight rooms and all that sort of stuff. It's a whole different animal, you know, mid-70s, you know, or late, you know, mid to late 70s coming out of high school. I mean, it's got to be night and day compared to, you know, those guys. And a lot of it's on a maturity level as well. And that's I'm always still stunned that as many guys that do come straight from high school are as mature as they are, because it's, and of course there are situations or there's examples of guys that weren't, but man, knowing me, what I was, you know, when I was 19, like being in a professional sport, like I can't even fathom how I would handle that, you know, mentally and or physically. So no, it's something to be said, especially in the era that they did that and be sort of the trailblazers of it as well is impressive. Cause I'm sure there were a lot of guys, and I'm sure, you know, in terms of like locker rooms and guys you deal with, I mean, these are, you know, grown ass men that are, you know, hanging around with an 18-year-old. Like that's different. You know, me and my age, I don't want to hang around with 18-year-olds. I doubt, like, you know, some 12-year NBA veteran wants some 18-year-old rolling up and, you know, taking a spot on the team.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's a lot. Yeah, I could see that being a.
Yeah, I think that how it affects the team culture, the maturity stuff. I think that is sort of over a little bit when it comes in terms of, you know, whether players should be able to come into the when they're 18.
Oh no,
this isn't the time to get into a deep conversation about that, but I do think like that is an important aspect that isn't necessarily talked about, like whether, you know, a player may be ready to contribute on the court, or at least something on the court, but the being able to handle being a professional and, you know, and being part of a team with maturity, that's a whole different thing. But I mean, and I there's some evidence that Doc that really well. I mean, his first year in 76 only played 165 minutes, so played very little. Apparently he his coach Gene Shue did not play him because he was eating chocolate bars on the bench, so you know, and would like he was in the kind of a culture.
See, that's
where
I would do if I was an 18-year-old,
right?
I would be eating Twix bars, yeah, all the time.
I mean, he was in a culture where guys were, you know, like, you know, drinking and smoking in the locker room, and you know, there were a lot of free spirits on that Sixers team, but they, you know, they had gone from, they were the 9-win team in 73 to a 46-win team in just 3 seasons. They had Doug Collins, George McGinnis was the first year there. Steve Mix had been there for a couple years. Fred Carter had been there since the rough days, and Billy Cunningham had come back from the ABA. They also had World Be Free and Joe Bryant, who would be, you know, who would kind of be part of the next couple years, strong teams. And in fact, you know, Collins said that he thought that, you know, coming in at 18 on such like, you know, a veteran and, you know, soon to be championship level team maybe affected his development, made him kind of defer when he, you know, maybe in a different situation would have, you know, kind of been forced to sort of be like the, you know, the primary guy. But
Yeah, and I think that's another difference too with the culture and everything that we talk about now versus then or whatever. Whereas now, when a guy came as, you know, I think a lot of guys, you talk about a guy like LeBron who, you know, comes straight from high school and into the league or whatever, and these guys that are, you know, are playing with him have known about him since he was 12, 13, 14 or whatever, know what he's capable of, know that he, and understand, hey, that's fine, and give him the confidence that, hey, look, you're the man, like, go do your thing or whatever, like, you're good enough to do this and make this leap or whatever. Whereas I could generally see, not that Dawkins wasn't, you know, a well-renowned, you know, high school player, but yeah, I still think at that time it's a whole different animal when these guys are just not, I mean, they've just, it's never happened before. And you look at guys that are going, you know, what is this guy? And I could see from Dawkins' standpoint, him not wanting to say, okay, yeah, you know, just give me the ball and let me do my thing. And they're like, oh yeah, who are you? Like, you know, we've been, you know, we're, you know, veterans, we're this, we're that. I could absolutely see it being a big deal then compared to now. And I think we take it for granted now that we've, you know, seen so many players, maybe not, you know, the prep to pro doesn't happen, you know, now anymore, of course, but obviously the one and dones, I don't think are on a different maturity level than, you know, a ton of those either. I mean, it's not much different. So we talk about that and, you know, yeah, but I think, to do it and be the trailblazer in something like that, I think is really significant. I don't know if we give enough, you know, kind of credit to guys like Moses Malone and Daryl Dawkins in terms of being the trailblazers for that. And obviously it took many, many years for it to, you know, come back, and it was Kevin Garnett, as you mentioned, but I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, that has to be a daunting task to be an 18-year-old and, you know, just hop into the league at that time and in that era is impressive.
Yeah. And in the next year, you know, in the 77 season, Dr. J joins the team. Henry Bibby and Caldwell Jones are added as well. Cunningham retires. And Dawkins only played 684 regular season minutes, but he played 331 in the playoffs. So he was a big part of that. They made the finals that year after beating the defending champion Celtics and then beating the Moses Malone-led Rockets. And famously, we talked about this a bit on our last podcast. Famously, they made the finals against Portland. They were up 2-0, and then they lost the next four games. And kind of the game-changing or the series-changing incident was a fight between Dawkins and Maurice Lucas. And sort of there was sort of an incident where after he felt his teammates didn't, you know, give him his back during that time, he was so mad that he tore lockers from the walls. He caved in a toilet stall and barricaded the door so that the team could not get back into the dressing room. So and that was kind of credited for being, you know, like it'd be basically changing around the entire series and leading to Portland winning. And I'm sure there was more to it than that, but that's, you know, just a and they were very much a team with a lot of guys. You know, they had a lot of guys who wanted to score. You know, World Be Free, George McGinnis was a gunner, you know, Irving was a great player, but he obviously, you know, was, you know, the primary scorer generally. So there were a lot of mouths to feed there. So mm-hmm. A lot of interesting chemistry there. But I think the thing that, you know, he deserves credit for certainly is like, hey, he's a 20-year-old and he's, you know, putting serious minutes in for a team that came very close to winning a championship.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we talked about that a little bit where, you know, you have a guy who maybe at this point, you know, the accomplishments. I mean, we talk about, you know, a guy that maybe doesn't have the sort of resume and the backing. And so and this is one of those years where you kind of look at it and you look at, oh, man, you know, with all that talent and with, you know, this guy being one of the primary guys, like, you know, they couldn't do it. And you know, again, I don't think that's fair at all. And I think, yeah, it's we don't really talk about this team all that much because, you know, they didn't, you know, end up winning it all, but it's a really, really good, like historically real good team as well.
Yeah. I mean, and they made, you know, as we'll kind of go through, they made, four finals in 6 years, or I'm sorry, three finals in 6 years. And until, you know, and then they won the championship the year that he left, but it's still, I mean, they were, you know, they were a very good team. They were always contenders there and he was a big part of that team and he was growing in his role. I mean, in 78, he's up to, he's basically a full-time player. He's off the bench, but he's playing 25 minutes a game up to, 1700 minutes. Cunningham becomes the coach six games in that season. And they're the same team. Otherwise they perform well during the regular season and sweep the Knicks in the playoffs, but then they're upset by the Bullets, who ended up winning the title that year in the Eastern Conference Finals. The Bullets only won 44 games, and the Sixers won like 56 games, or, you know, and were a real good team. The And 79 is a watershed year because 79 is the – he broke two glass backboards in a three-week span. The first one, you know, the really, really famous one with just like the glass like shattering and then and Robezine like, you know, putting his hands over his head and everyone trying to get out of the way.
I watched that again. I was like, dude, that guy, like, he doesn't get out of the, like, and I get, like, you don't really kind of know what's happening in that moment, but you look at the replay and you look at, you know, Dawkins kind of knows and gets out of the way. But you just said his name and I'm
Bill Robezine, right? Yeah,
he's just like under it. It's just like falling out of it. He's just like, he just covers his eyes with his hands and it's like, oh my God, like I can't imagine what that, like just glass just falling into your face. Like it's really remarkable. It's such a fun video to watch. I've seen it like 100 times, but just, you know, people replaying it now, it's just amazing to see it. It's just like the most, you know, poignant display of just, you know, athleticism and strength. Like you don't just seeing that guy just rip that thing apart. It's unbelievable. I love it. It's one of my favorite things to watch in NBA history. Like my favorite highlight almost ever of NBA history.
Yeah.
That and the one where Shaq grabs like the whole freaking, like the basket just comes down. He just rips it apart. It's like, oh my God. Like,
yeah.
What are you? Like, what the hell?
All right. Like, I like the chocolate thunder flying, Robezine crying, teeth shaking, glass breaking, rump roasting, bun toasting, wham bam, glass breaker, I am jam. So
yep.
It took him a week to come up with that one, but that's a pretty good name.
That's another great story too. When I was reading the articles, people were like, what do you call that one, Doc? And he's like, I don't know yet. Like, yeah. And then like comes back with a week later with a piece of paper. Here, this is what you should call it. Like, that's the best part too, is that I know this guy generally went home and was like, okay, let's think here. Like, what am I going to call this thing? Like, I can't, like, because you can't just throw something out immediately. And like, it's got to be a big deal because this is like a historic thing. So I'm glad he waited and made it worth it. And this was definitely a worth it name. So,
So the Sixers, they kind of fell a bit to only 47 wins. Irving had kind of a down year that year for whatever reason. But he bounced back in a big way the next year. And then that was Dawkins' first year past 2000 minutes, which he would basically stay, for the most part for the rest of his career until he, you know, started to be felled by injuries. The Sixers traded McGinnis for Bobby Jones. Robby Free was traded to the Clippers for, and I didn't know this until now, for the pick that became Charles Barkley in 84. So,
oh, nice.
I know you love that sort of thing.
I do love that. Yes,
that's Maurice Cheek's first his rookie year, and the Sixers beat the Nets that year, who were one of our choices for worst playoff teams ever in our worst playoff teams ever podcast. But they fell to the Spurs in 7 games in the second round. So, that was sort of a, that was a strong first year for, or a strong kind of, you know, first like big year for, Dawkins, and he averaged, 13 points, 6.5 rebounds in 26 minutes a game. The next year he'd play 32 minutes a game, be up to 14 points, 7 minutes and 8.7 rebounds. That was probably the peak season of his career in Philly in terms of production. When he moved to New Jersey, he did have slightly stronger raw totals anyway. And he would always he was pretty efficient in his shooting. I mean, he led the league in true shooting percentage later on in his career. I mean, he didn't have much of a range, but I feel like the other thing about him is, like, he didn't really have a polished game, but he certainly had an effective game. And I think people tend to look at, like, an unpolished game and sort of think, like, oh, he's not working hard. You know, when, you know, if it's working, if it's effective, it's effective, you know?
Yeah, exactly. No, and it's not like, you know, he wasn't going to be your prototypical sort of, especially at that time, or, you know, what we think of, I got like a Tim Duncan or whatever, like a back to the basket guy who was going to, you know, outmove you and outsmart you and all that sort of stuff. He was going to use a lot of his, you know, raw ability that he had and a lot of the raw skills. But yeah, like you said, he wasn't a guy who just couldn't finish. I mean, when he got near the rim, he finished, and it's, you know, he's top 10 all time in effective field goal percentage. He's, you know, 14th all time in true shooting percentage. Yeah. So he, you know, it wasn't like a guy he was great at that. I mean, he was great at putting the ball in the basket when he was nearby. I mean, 7th all time in effective field goal is nothing to slouch at. There's a lot of real big guys that are taller than him, probably guys that are stronger than him that have way less, you know, rankings than that. So he was good at that. I mean, that was his game, and, you know, you can't really fault the guy for that. He wasn't gonna outwork you with back to the basket moves and dribbles and all that sort of stuff, but he was gonna score on you if you were near the rim. So
absolutely. And Then 1980, they make the finals but lose to the Lakers in six. They do blow through the Bullets, the Hawks, and the famously the Celtics. That was Larry Bird's first season. They're roughly the same team, except they added Lionel Hollins in midseason. We talked about that a little bit in our last podcast as well. And then in 81, they're up to 62 wins. They added Andrew Toney. That was Doug Collins last year. He only played about 12 games. Henry Bibby was also off the team. So they're kind of making the transition to, you know, they have almost all the key players they would have on the later Sixers teams that would, you know, kind of extend, be pretty good through until like 86 or so. And got kind of have lost most of the guys from the 77 team, except, of course, for Dr. J. And then 82, they're still just about as good, 58 wins, but Dawkins only played in 48 games, although he returned for the playoffs, and that kind of led to like a little bit of a division in the organization, because like he thought that that you know, he showed a lot of, you know, hard work and in coming back from that injury and you know, playing you know, through that and coming back early. And then he felt like the 76ers owner and, you know, some of the management and coaches, you know, kind of just said like that they thought he didn't consistently work hard enough for the money he was being paid. And that was kind of a theme throughout his career. I mean, there were a lot of people, you know, even teammates of his who said like, you know, yeah, maybe he didn't really work the hardest. He didn't necessarily consider it serious business. There were kind of there's an SI article that you kind of referenced from one of his coaches. I'm blanking on who that was right now, but
Dave Wolf.
That's right.
Dave
yes. Wolf. And you know, and said that, you know, there were kind of split opinions about whether college would have helped him. Most people kind of thought he would. You know, Dr. J kind of said like, well, you know, he didn't always work the hard. I mean, he was a good teammate, but, you know, but if he had worked harder, maybe he wouldn't have been able to handle it either, because that would have led to, you know, more issues for him. So, but it was just interesting the way that, you know, he was kind of portrayed, and also a little bit of a split personality in terms of, you know, being such a generous guy, but also being a little bit weird about like not always paying guys back for things. And, you know, he had some turmoil in his personal life as well. You know, that led, you know, that it talked about. So it was in 88 kind of when he was basically done in his career. We'd have a little bit of a cup of coffee with the Pistons, but that was basically about it, at least for his NBA career.
Yeah, and of course, there's a few years with the Nets or whatever, and you know, famously, what he's kind of renowned for, I think, in some ways, is his propensity for fouling. And he, in two consecutive years, I think it was 83 was his first year. He set the NBA record for 379 fouls in his season, and then in 1984, topped his own record with 386, and that record remains still the top. So your top two personal fouls in a season, Daryl Dawkins, still your man. So
yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Very impressive. Not an all-time. I mean, I think he's, I forgot, I don't have it in front of me. I think he's top 10 all-time in personal fouls, but just doesn't have the longevity of other famous foul men. But yeah, no, he's got the number one and the number two all-time foul seasons. Yeah, his Nets career was, I mean, he had, like you mentioned, one of his, you know, statistically greatest years in terms of like points and all those things in 1984. But the injuries started piling up for him, and his body just kind of betrayed him, and that's when it really sort of, in a sense, you know, we don't have very vivid memories of his Nets career, you know, in a lot of ways, just because there were so few games that he was playing, and when he was playing, a lot of the effectiveness was you know, starting to leave because the body was just going. I mean, back, knees, feet, ankle. I mean, just everything was kind of piling up.
Yeah, I mean, he did have strong years in 83 and 84. In 84, they did manage to upset the Sixers in the first round, who, of course, were the defending champs. He had been, you know, the reason he was traded to the Nets is to sort of make room for Moses Malone's salary room. Like, Moses was sort of a separate trade based on, you know, he was signed as a free agent and the trade was for compensation. And then, you know, Dawkins was traded before that to, you know, make room salary wise for him, and I guess somewhat of a role as well. But yeah, in 84, you know, he, you know, that may have been his sort of his peak years, 27 that year. You know, he was 17 and 7 for the season. Shot well. Other than the propensity to foul, he did well. They he actually led the team in scoring in the second round, in a second round loss to the Bucks. He had 22.3 points per game in that series. So, you know, I mean, they had they had some potential. I mean, they weren't going to be much better than that. Then they were felt. They had their issues too. We talked about that a little bit in the Michael Ray Richardson episode.
Exactly.
But yeah, and then the next two scenes, he was, you know, yeah, both were injury plague seasons. And then from 87 to 89, he played 26 games over three seasons, played four games in Utah and 16 games in Detroit to end his career. He was on the 89 Pistons, but it was not part of the postseason roster, so he never got a ring, unfortunately.
Oh. Boo.
I'm sorry. But, you know, he had a nice he had a fun post-playing career. He spent some seasons in the Italian League. He played for the Globetrotters for a little bit. He in 1996, he was with – he would have been about close to 40 by then. He was with the Sioux Falls Skyforce of the CBA. And then was, you know, finally retired in 2000. He, as we mentioned before, was ambassador of the game, made the transition to coaching as well as the head coach of the Lehigh Carbon Community College men's basketball team. So, you know, he was around the game for, you know, basically his entire life, and did, you know, a lot of neat stuff.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. I mean, we live in a society now where this is, you know, something that's possible. And it's almost kind of sad as I went through, you know, Daryl Dawkins' Twitter account because people were saying, oh, he was, you know, just a few days ago tweeting about the Little League World Series or whatever. So I went and I was trying to, you know, look at what he did. And as I mentioned, you know, in our earlier portion, you see him and he's sharing a bunch of pictures of him just at like a rec center, just teaching. I think they're like 10 or 11 year old girls or something like that. And there's Earl Dawkins on the sideline in his nice suit, like coaching them. And that's something like that is just so cool to see a guy who isn't sick of the game at any point. You know, up until the day he died, literally, he was not sick of the game, like enjoyed the game, still liked going out there, and still, as you said, the ambassador of the game. And I think that's the most important thing that I always got from him. And that's my earliest memories of Daryl Dawkins were, you know, growing up and as a judge in the dunk contest. Like every single year, they would cut to the table, and there's Daryl Dawkins in his awesome suit, you know, holding up a number, talking about the guys that are dunking or whatever. And it's just, I love that aspect of him. That's something I really just enjoyed about, you know, researching about him and reading about him and all that sort of stuff is that guy who just loved the game of basketball, loved just living, loved being Daryl Dawkins. You know, I mentioned the quote earlier. He was perfectly happy just being himself and just a guy who just seemed to enjoy everything about his life. And that's something that's really cool. Like nothing at any point seemed to really get him down or get him depressed or get him upset. Like that's when you read about him and we're reading stories here and we're reading this sort of stuff. And yeah, there was some issues, you know, in the late 70s with his personal life and that sort of stuff. But pretty much from like that point until, you know, earlier this week when he passed away, it's everything. He's pretty much just a guy who just, you don't hear anything really bad about him. Nobody says anything bad about the guy. No one says, oh yeah, but he did this. I mean, it's just the only thing you hear is, oh, he didn't reach his potential. And we kind of talked with Iago. That's, shut up. Like, who cares?
He was the guy people seemed to like having around. So that's certainly worth quite a lot.
Exactly.
And I mean, I just love some of the colorful stuff about him that he created the whole, a persona that he was the alien from the planet Lovetron. He frolicked with his girlfriend, Juicy Lucy, and spread the gossip of interplanetary funkmanship. It's from a friend Blindberry piece at NBA.com. He had kind of a quote about talking about the backboard breaking dunk and said, I wasn't snarling or spitting at anybody. I was never trying to hurt anybody or be mean. I was just having fun. And yes, I knew all about marketing. And that's the kind of thing that I think, like, you know, Dawkins was certainly like a guy who, you know, he liked to have the attention on and stuff. He liked to show off. You know, he liked the he signed his first pro contract wearing a bright red suit and top hat. World Be Free said that Dawkins glowed in the dark, you know, even from his wardrobe, you know. And Mike Dunleavy had a story about how Dawkins drove a Corvette that was painted so many colors that Dunleavy said it looked like a meteorite. So, the point being is that, like, it wasn't like it was showing off and it was, but it was all meant to be in fun. It wasn't like trying to, like, necessarily, like, you know, completely, like, destroy the other guy or to be, like, you know, to embarrass anyone else. It was just sort of like, you know, just, you know, we want to be a goofball. We want to, to have fun. And that's,
yeah.
And that's neat. I think before we go, we need to talk about our favorite dunks and some of the best dunk nicknames as well.
Yes. Well, actually, two things real quick. Yeah, one thing that I mentioned, and sort of just wanted to mention this because it was something I wanted to talk about when we did this entire thing, is that one thing that I got from Dawkins and reading about him and researching him and all that sort of stuff is that, and you kind of alluded to it in the last point, he was a showman, he was entertaining or whatever, but he's the rare case of a showman who's also super humble. You know, it's very weird, and I don't know quite how to describe it, but if you kind of know and have researched and looked at Dawkins, that's sort of what he was. He's a guy who loved being the center of attention, but at the same time didn't necessarily want to be the, you know what I mean? Like he was happy just being himself, but also at the same time himself was kind of like, yeah, I kind of want people to look at me. I don't want everybody to, you know, care about every move I'm doing, but you should look at me because I'm pretty fun to look at. And, you know, I do fun things and I'm entertaining and all that sort of stuff. And I thought I enjoyed that. And another thing, it was a tweet from Dave McMahon, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, who told the tale about his dad. So essentially, I'll read the tweet here real quick. It's not a whole lot, but this is like my favorite story of the day that I read. My favorite Daryl Dawkins story told to my dad by a former equipment guy for the 76ers and retold by my dad a thousand times. Sorry. It's some point in the early 80s and the Sixers regular season practice facility is out of commission for the day. So the players have to report to some rinky-dink high school gym on the main line for practice instead. It's dead of winter. The gym is drafty, low ceiling, stage behind the basket, uneven hardwood floor. You get the picture. Definitely not NBA caliber. The team is warm up and Dr. J complains about the conditions in the layup line. Dawkins tells Irving all in this practice right now before it can even begin. And then he says the man known as Chocolate Thunder takes his place in the line, goes up for a dunk, purposely tearing the rim down in the process. Practice is over, coach, he went on to tell Billy Cunningham.
There's another great story that I from the SI article from Cunningham, where he basically says, Daryl wasn't pushing himself, so I stopped practice. I went over to him and really read him the riot act, really yelled at him. He had his head down and promised me he would do better. And then he later says, and then as I walked away, he tripped me. I couldn't believe it. What can you do? I finally cracked up laughing like everyone else.
How do you get mad at that guy? And the smile too. I mean, I'm sure even if he was being a real dickhead or something, he just smiled and you were like, all right,
there you go.
He just had a great, like such an all time great smile. We were like, all right, like I'm sure Billy, like imagine an NBA coach, like tripping an NBA coach, like pretty much anybody else would get even chewed out more, but it was him. And I was like, oh, all right. Like, can you imagine Jack? You don't trip Jack Ramsey.
You would probably not trip Rick.
I don't think that was going to go well.
Probably helpful that Cunningham had just been a player like a year or two before.
Exactly.
But
right.
Yes.
Right,
yeah. So what are your favorite dunks, or what's your favorite dunk of his non-backboard shattering edition?
Yeah, I think, you know, going through the highlights and watching, one of my favorite ones, I mean, there was one where the NBA had a top 20 Daryl Dawkins dunks video, if you want to seek that out. The number one is, I agree with the number one. It's probably not my favorite, but my God, there's one where someone takes a shot, it's off or whatever, so three Phoenix Suns go up for a rebound, and Dawkins just skies over all of them and does a putback, and it's like the most incredible thing, because all these guys, and these guys aren't just like on their toes, like they're kind of jumping, but he just jumps so far ahead of all of them that he just goes and gets the rebound and, you know, dunks. It's just incredible. That's, I'm cool with that number one. The one that I love, though, and it's one of my favorite dunks of all time, and guys don't really do it anymore, it's very 80s, it's very, you know, late 70s, 80s is perfect for him, is the, you know, the behind the head two-handed dunk, like the ferocious, like guys don't do that one anymore, and if they do, it's very rare, but like that, you know what I mean, where you completely bent elbows and just bam, just throw that thing in there, and that's one of my favorite ones to do on, like, you know, I'm not coordinated enough, so when I'm dunking on like 7-foot rims, I can't really do like between the legs and all that mumbo jumbo, so I have to do this one, and that's sort of just my favorite one, because there's just so much power, and you can make the sound of that one sound so cool, because you just throw that ball down, and Dawkins was so good at that one, and I loved when he did that one, but yeah, that's going to be my favorite. I don't have a specific one, I don't know what he named that one, but yeah, the behind the head, you know, two-handed, just jam right there. I love that one.
Yeah, mine, I liked the swing over the shoulder. I guess it's sort of a windmill type jump dunk. It was number 7 on the list, and I've seen it done otherwise, but that one is just like, for him, like at that like size and strength, like kind of get that rotation and get like that, you know, I mean, it wasn't just like a power dunk, it was like a grace and power dunk.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's one of the things of watching this sort of highlights is that's a guy who, you know, he had those ferocious dunks, and he had, obviously, I mean, we talked about that a bunch, but he had also ones too, and watching those highlights, where there were ones that were pretty finesse style. I mean, if he was a guy who, as you said, in terms of like the dunk culture, if he had came up, you know, 10 years later or, you know, 15 years later, like a guy like, you know, being that size and being able to have that combo, I mean, that's a dunk contest legend there. You know, a guy that can kind of do both those things of finesse and power. But, you know, of course he came in an era where it wasn't quite at that level yet. But yeah, no, it's his dunks are the thing of beauty, and you don't want to just focus on the dunks and just focus on that. But still, you know, the guy was an all time great dunker. Like, there's no way around it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, as far as the nicknames go, so these are all the nicknames that I could find for his dunks. Yo Mama, Spine Chiller Supreme, Rim Wrecker, Dunk You Very Much, Hammer of Thor, Flop-a-Dop, Gorilla, Sexophonic, Turbo Delight, Look Out Below, The In Your Face Disgrace, The Cover Your Head, and The Spine Chiller Supreme. So what's your favorite name?
I think I'm going to go with Gorilla because, let's see. Oh man, that was that. I jumped into that. I shouldn't do that. Let me think here. I think the In Your Face Disgrace.
Oh, see, that was going to be mine. So now
I'm sorry. Yeah, read them all. I mean, that is definitely the best.
That one's great. I like the Dunk You Very Much. And, you know, the Sexophonic Turbo Delight, I'm not going to turn up my nose at that one, you know?
I wish I owned an ice cream parlor. You know what I mean? Like, these are all really awesome
there
names.
You go.
For ice cream. Like, did he ever do that? Did he ever franchise a series of ice cream?
It could be like a Daryl Duncan's, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, how did he not do it? He had to have done that, right?
I mean, you would think so.
Maybe, what a waste.
Maybe the Dunkin' Donuts people. If you could just, like, coordinate with the Dunkin' Donuts people, that would have been, you know, there's
exactly,
a good idea there.
I got to imagine the Ben & Jerry's Corporation called that man at some point to name, right? Like, there's no way there wasn't an ice cream flavor that he wasn't at least at some point consulted on, right?
Yeah.
There's just no way. There's no way. I'm not listening to it. There's no way. So,
so anything else, Rich?
No, I think that's it. I think we did a good job covering him. And, you know, like you said, it sucks because this is the guy that was always on our list of a guy, hey, let's do like a really long, you know, in-depth podcast about. And unfortunately, he jumped the list by a lot. And that, you know, it's unfortunate like that, you know, that we had to do it under these circumstances. But with that said, I think you look at this guy and I think what's been cool about the past few days is it's been, and that's what I really like when you know, I don't like death, of course, but when death can be sort of a situation where people can, you know, either discover stuff they didn't know, learn about a guy's career, learn about a guy's life, and just celebrate his life and celebrate his career and all that sort of stuff. And that's been the best thing that I've enjoyed about this week and, you know, the stuff after, you know, his passing is people have come out with these great stories and these great articles, and I'm just seeing videos and all that sort of stuff. And it's a guy that you're getting an extra appreciation for. And it sucks that it takes the death to do that, but in a lot of ways, it's let me appreciate this guy a lot more, and a guy that I don't think I necessarily did appreciate, you know, very much until his passing. So it sucks in that respect, but it's cool too that we can come on here and talk about him and talk about his career and talk about his life and you know, really enjoy doing it and really have a fun time with it. So
yeah, for sure. You can check us out. Of course, our podcast is housed at harvardparoxysm.com. You can Over and Back now has its own iTunes feed in addition to the HP Network iTunes feed. So we would love reviews and ratings in both if possible. But either one, we would be happy. You can find our forums at overandbacknba.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook, both at overandbacknba. We'll be back next week with some more episodes of our Top 50 project, which we plan to continue until just before the season begins. So hopefully everyone's enjoying that. Hopefully everyone enjoyed our last episode on the breaks of the game, which is one of my favorite ones I've ever done. So until next time, thanks very much.